last week? Anybody? Verse 22 of what? Verse 22, or is it verse? I got verse 24 of Matthew 17, right? At least that's what I got. Did I skip or what? Yeah, we talked about that last week. So we're at the bottom of page 52 on our lesson books, Matthew 17, beginning of verse 24 to the end of the chapter. That's the text that we're starting with. We're going to finish up this lesson. We're going to go on to lesson 14 this morning. And so in this lesson that we've spoken about Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah, we've spoken about the transfiguration. We're sort of closing this lesson right now. And there was a lot going on, so I don't think I have slides for lesson 14, but all that's on here is stuff that's already on your page, right? So, as well, do we have anybody here who has not yet received one of these, or a visitor that would like to borrow one? If you have not yet received them, then I will give one to you. But if you have received it, you haven't gotten one yet, okay. But if you have received one and you left it at home, that is not my problem. No, it's not my problem. Or if you received one and you gave it away, well, then I can make allowances. I got two left. You guys got one of these. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you guys got one of these a long time ago. So. Those are my last two. We're dealing with sort of the close of the events that follow from the Transfiguration right now. And as they're sort of on their way, they get back to Galilee, right? They come back to Capernaum, which often served as Jesus' home base while he was teaching in Galilee. According to Mark chapter 2, that's where his house was. He had a house in Capernaum. Mark chapter 2 is pretty clear about that. That's where Peter, Andrew, James, and John all lived. They come back to Capernaum, right? And something happens there. There's some tax collectors, collectors of the two drachma tax. They come up to Peter, and they ask a question, right? What do they ask Peter? Does your master pay the tax or not? Right. So what is this tax, first of all? It's for the temple, right? Right? It's for the temple. It's a taxation for the support of the temple. So, first of all, is this lawful according to the law of Moses?
Yes, it talks about Exodus 30.
Exodus 30, there's the annual tithe. Yeah. But that's the annual tithe, right? This seems like it's in addition to the annual tithe, right? There's something interesting going on here, right? So this guy comes up and says, does your master not pay the tax? So there is an annual tithe that is required of Israelites, right? First of all, that's not the only payment that they would give, by the way. The annual tithe was for the support of the tabernacle and the Levites. And all the other things going on, right? This maintaining of the city's refuge, all these other things. And then there's, in addition to that, there was an additional tithe that was paid every 3 years, so it was triannual. So every 3 years, you pay another 10%. And that actually is entirely set aside for cash assistance for the poor. It was social welfare. Right? And then there's all the sacrifices that you come to offer. And so some Israelites are paying as much as 40 to 45% of their income at the end of the day, the wealthier ones in particular. But Now, you've got all this going on, and so this guy comes and says, does your master not pay the tax? And so what's Peter's answer? Yes, he pays the tax, all right? So he goes to Jesus, right? When they came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, and he asked Peter a question, right? What question does he ask Peter? Simon, what's the question? The kings of the earth, right? From whom do they collect taxes? From their sons or from others? And Peter's like, well, duh, others, right? The 2 drachma tax, right? This was an annual tax that was collected after each annual census of Israel. What's mandated by the law is a tithe. It's a 10%. That's what's supposed to be given. A 2 drachma tax is about a half a shekel, right? It was originally applied for the tabernacle. It's later applied to the temple, right? And so as the course of time went by, what ends up happening is, when you calculate a percentage of income, unless you have, a system like ours, W-2 withholding, right, all that stuff, you actually have to assess people's income, right? Which means you need to take a measurement of their income. And without, our modern digital world makes that easy to keep track of, right? But without that, it becomes significantly more difficult. So what ended up happening is they standardized the tax. I mean, it became sort of a flat tax. And that happened over time, right? And so the initial assessment that's described in the law is a 10% tithe. And you're supposed to be accountable for that personally. What ends up happening is there's a base rate that everybody has to pay. And then if you want to pay more, you can pay more. And so the Pharisees made a big show of paying more a lot of the time. And they made a big deal about it, and they let everybody know that they were paying more. And so that's sort of the setup that's going on at this point in time, is that the 10% had evolved sort of into a standardized rate. And so that's essentially the setup, at least from what I've read. Well, the 2 drachmas is actually not that much at all. It's almost nothing, as a matter of fact. This would have been easily affordable by everybody.
So is that an excuse to give?
No, it's not an excuse not to give, right? And what ended up happening is that the wealthier families, so the sociological evolution of Israel is kind of interesting. And that the wealthier families often wanted to be viewed as more pious. And so they would make a show of giving more, right? And when they did that and they let everybody know, well, philanthropy, giving more to God makes people, causes people to look well at you if they know you're doing it. Of course, there's a bit of hypocrisy involved in that, because if you're doing it so that other people will see you doing it, then Jesus says that's all the reward you're ever going to get is the accolades from men, not the accolades from God. And so that's kind of what happened. So the temple ended up being fully funded because of people's appetite for political power, essentially. And sort of as a result of the interaction, the politicization of the temple, you've got a lot of interesting things, sort of resulting from that. One is that the temple has more money than they know what to do with. So the priests in Israel live lives of lavish wealth. And the people that they gave sort of religious favors to paid them for it. And you have a system in place by that time through the intersection of the wealth that the temple had accumulated and the relationship between those in political power and the temple and the collaboration between them. You get a system not unlike the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, as a matter of fact, when you have the selling of indulgences, for example. by the Church of Rome, that, you know, the popes and cardinals and archbishops would say, okay, I'll promise you forgiveness in the future for whatever sin you want to commit if you give me lots of money, okay? And it's not exactly that sort of the Catholic form, but, you know, the Jews didn't really do things that way, but there was a relationship symbiotically between those in political power in the temple that is a result of the monetary interaction between them. And so the temple had more money than it knew what to do with in the days of Jesus. And the priests lived extremely wealthy, lavish lifestyles in spite of the fact that most people just paid a lot of the poorer people paid the two drachma tax, and that was pretty much it, aside from their sacrifices, of course. And so, you know, what you have is you have, you know, if one person doesn't pay this, the temple's not going to hurt at all. But it's a system that wasn't put in place by the law. I mean, it finds its roots officially in the law. And like Elmer mentioned in Exodus 30, you find the instructions for the annual tithe. But it's a system that itself is not found in the law. I think it's what, starting verse 11, the instructions about the tithe. Verse 11, yeah, like 11 to 16, right? Right? And so you find this interesting system that has evolved over time that's not what the law prescribes, but it leads to certain abuses. And so, you know, when you've got this system that has become abused and not what it was originally intended to be, you know, there's the question, should I even participate, right? Because it's not what it's supposed to be. Well, what Jesus says to his disciples is, you know, there's this interesting question that Jesus poses Peter, right? He says, you know, who do they tax? Their sons or other people, right? So what's Peter's answer is, of course, well, they tax other people, not their sons. What does Jesus imply by that? He doesn't need to pay. He is God, right? He's paying himself. He's paying himself, right? It's like, I'm going to pay it. It belongs to me, right? If it's a temple, well, that's my house, right? I own that. I mean, and it's, you know, God owns all of the earth, right? But there's a special way in which the things of God really, really do belong to Jesus personally, right? And so he says, well, from others. Well, I'm not other. But so that they won't be offended, we'll go ahead and pay them anyway. Yeah, Elmore?
Well, you know, that was a long time, right, on Exodus chapter 11.
1,500 years.
Yes. So now that's carried in some ways politicized it now. On Mark 12, the widow offering.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, Mark 12 is an example of exactly the thing I was talking about. The Pharisees and the Sadducees and the other wealthy individuals of Judea giving lavish contributions to the temple, overfunding it, but they're doing so for political reasons, right? Not for genuine, heartfelt, you know, devotion to God. And it became this massive problem in Israel, in their day. So, well, we're kind of going through that, right? There we go. Yeah?
I think for me it's amazing what Jesus did. So he decided to pay anyway, regardless of whether it's right or not, right? Because he said that not to pay.
Yeah. It is kind of amazing, isn't it? Right? That he has Peter go ahead and pay. Because, you know, first of all, he owns all this, right? Like in a very literal, real way, it's his. But there's something interesting to be said of that. Let's go back to when he sent the 12 out, right? When he's preparing the 12 for their first mission by themselves, right? He says, and going back to Matthew 10, right, which sort of kicked a lot of this into motion, right? He says, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, he says, they have to be two things. Do you guys remember what they are? As crafty as serpents or as cunning as serpents, but as gentle as doves. As gentle as doves. And let's go ahead and pay it. I mean, is it going to hurt? Yeah. Sherry? What's that? Oh, okay. I was going to say, you know, you look at the scenario, and Jesus' assessment is the law demands that Israel pay, you know, for the upkeep of the tabernacle, right? Now, they're not collecting what they're actually supposed to be collecting, which from most people, they would actually be collecting more. From a lot of people, they'd be collecting less. So there's an interesting question going on. Do I pay the 10% or do I pay what they're asking me to pay? And what's the situation that's... And you know, here's something to think about. What is James... How does James end the passage on the wisdom from above versus the wisdom from below? James chapter 3, verse 18. The last verse in that passage. It was our annual theme last year. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who do what? Make peace. There is a time and a place for correction. There's a time and a place to have these discussions, right? Sometimes, now is not the time. And in some places, this is not the place. There are more important things to concern. We'll get to this eventually, right? But for now, there are more important things to worry about. This is about prioritization. You know, yes, things are a little wonky right now, okay? And should it be addressed? Yeah. But there are more important things to consider in the immediate moment. And so for now, what Jesus says, what you've got to do is which choice here is going to create the least amount of conflict, right? Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, right? We always have to remember those statements that he made. And the example that he sets here, saying, you know what, okay, yeah, but there are bigger fish to fry at the moment. Jerry. Possible, but the word here for isn't sort of strangers as in foreigner. It's actually a different word. It's for not of your family, right? I mean, it's certainly possible that we're talking about ethnicity, but the basic, a fundamental interpretation of the text that just looks at everything at face value for what the simplest, most obvious explanation is, sort of leans to way the ESV translates it, as opposed to not strangers, but others, right? And especially since he uses the example of kings, I mean, what king doesn't tax his own people? I mean, all the kings tax their own people. And since we're talking about that, right, that's sort of the most common sense interpretation of the statement and the text and the words that are being used. And I happen to think that's right. And so we're talking about, you know, people, you know, the royal family versus everybody else, the common people. And especially since Jesus sort of inserts himself into that comparison, you know, the king and the son of a king, and then everybody else, I think that's probably the better way of looking at it. Although, I mean, there are histories, right, and examples of empires in which you have multiple ethnicities living under the same empire, right? And certain groups do get taxed more heavily. For example, the Arab Empire, right? Islam, the caliphates, right? You've got basically the only people who didn't get murdered for not converting to Islam originally were Jews and Christians. But Jews and Christians had to pay what's called the jizya. And the jizya was an extra tax that, you know, Jews and Christians had to pay the jizya. And the reason they were exempt from beheading was because at least they were people of the book and, you know, thought well of Abraham. But everybody else just got killed. So originally that was what happened in the caliphates. And so there are historical examples of that, but I mean, I don't know. It's possible, right? It's possible. I tend towards sort of the more, you know, king, his son, and then everybody else interpretation. But, you know, it could be that too. But the point, nevertheless, is, you know, there's something else, actually, that this reminds me of a lot. It's when Jesus and his disciples are walking through a field, and they're picking grain as they're going, and they're eating it, right? Do you guys remember that? And the Pharisees are walking with them. And what do the Pharisees say? You're working on the Sabbath. Okay? You guys remember what Jesus said? He says, have you not read how David ate from the bread of the presence? Right? Which it was unlawful for him to eat. I mean, haven't you read how law has been broken before, yet God did nothing about it, because God understands extenuating circumstances? And, you know, there's someone here greater than David, okay? And he said, so the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath, right? And the point that he was making in that statement is, I wrote the law, so I can choose when it's right to set it aside. And Jesus has that privilege. And there are certain, you know, there are certain aspects from the law, of the law from which Jesus is flat out exempt. Like sacrifice for sin. Did Jesus ever have to offer animal sacrifice? No. Never had to. Now, I don't know whether he did or not. It doesn't, the scripture doesn't say anything about him doing it, right? But I know he never needed to. Not even the guilt offering. The one that everybody's supposed to offer just sort of periodically all the time because of things that, you know you've done them, but you don't know what they are, right? He never even had to offer that. Yeah, Elmore? Yeah, well, I mean, there's something to that, right? And so Jesus is saying, look, and here he's bowing to what the law is, even though he doesn't need to do it. It's like sometimes, you know, we need to just assess our situation. And what's, you know, you got to pick your battles, right? Sometimes just bake the cake, okay? Seriously. Right. Right, and he's illustrating authority, right? But he's like, sometimes just bake the cake, all right? Is it really worth it? Right, exactly. And so, you know, sometimes, and I've said this before, right, but we'll say it again, right? Sometimes people can focus, Christians in particular, I've noticed, can focus so much on being right that they stop doing right. You guys know what I mean? We get so focused on being right that we stop doing right. And we actually, in our insistence upon, sometimes what we know is right. And in forcing everybody else to see that, we actually create strife.
What's the point of when you prove yourself to your brother, to prove him wrong, but yet you lose your brother.
Right, exactly. You know, and, you know, the thing that overrides Jesus' concern right here is, and the thing that we should be thinking about, because, you know, sometimes sin just needs to be called out as sin, no matter what the consequences are. And there are moments like that, where you just got to lay it out there and say, I don't care what you have to say or what you think, this is just wrong. Sometimes you got to do that, right? But the other thing we have to weigh is, on the other side of the coin, is our actions can alienate people from Christ, can drive them away from him. And we have to ask ourselves, are we doing that right now? right? And our insistence upon this thing or this thing, is that what we're actually accomplishing? And what it comes down to is an evaluation of priorities. And I mean, each decision has to be made in the context of each situation. Because in some situations, you're going to have to go one way. In some situations, you're going to have to bend and flex. Kennedy had his hand up, and then... Kennedy? Yeah, that's talking about civil authorities, but you know, the same principle hold, right? Pay taxes to whom taxes are due, right? I mean, the same general principle holds, even though that's... Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right, and you know, that's why we're you know, looking at it this way. You know, we got to learn what each circumstance is going to require. Sometimes you just, like I said, sometimes you're going to go to one way. Sometimes you're going to have to go to the other way. Everything has to be evaluated in its own context. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's because the circumstance, the context was different. You know, different things were going on, right? And that's sort of the lesson. So, getting into lesson 14. Yeah. Yeah. Or if, you know, yeah, Judy's right. Sometimes you just gotta, you know, let things slide a little bit. Or I'll say it a better way, suffer through it. Yeah. Right? That's a better way to talk about it. You know, God suffering through Israel. Which, you know, you read the book of Numbers, that's like the whole book. Sometimes you just gotta suffer through certain things, just like, alright, you know, whatever. This is life, right? Yeah, Kennedy, last point before we move on. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right, when he's talking to slaves, right? So, moving on, lesson 14, right? This is the one that... Oh, we don't have slides for. Oops. Okay, that's fine. It was a busy week. I'll have them next week, don't worry. So, moving on to lesson 14, right? Page 54, which is titled Important Principles, right? We can sort of stay in Matthew for now, because, you know, once again, Matthew seems to have a little bit more, at least for the first two sections of this lesson. We're going to stay in Matthew as our primary text, then we're going to go back to Luke. So for this section about, you know, false ambition and sin and forgiveness, we're staying in Matthew. So in Matthew chapter 18, right, beginning in about verse 1, it was sort of at this time, Matthew says, man, my goodness. At this time, the disciples came to Jesus, and they asked him a question. So what's the question they ask him? Who is the greatest in the kingdom? Right? Okay, which is like, oh, come on, can't you think of a better question? Right? Can't you think of a better question to ask? But, you know, here's the thing, is that they're sort of consumed by this push for status, right? And you know, when we get to... the night that precedes his crucifixion. I mean, this seems to be the running argument, right? You know how, I don't know how you guys are, but you know, you've got, how many people got, I know Pat and Phyllis have siblings, right? How many people got brothers and sisters? All right. Do you guys have those running arguments as you're growing up? Right? You know how it is? That one thing you come back, when you're bored, you argue about it because you got nothing else to do? Monica? Sure. Uh-huh. no, Dad's always right. That's how it works. But this is their default argument. You know, whenever they got nothing else to bicker about, they always come back to this. And it's an easy one to argue about because it's entirely subjective, right? Who's the greatest? I am. No, I am. It's like, I don't know. So just point out the ludicrous idiocy of this argument. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? God. Duh. I mean, come on. You can't answer that. It's like, seriously, none of you. That's who's the greatest. But here they are. The argument comes back around over and over again. And the thing that the most depressing part of it is that it doesn't just stay with the 12. Their moms get involved. It's like, I imagine, like, James and John's mom is that, like, soccer mom who's hovering on the field, like, harassing the coach. But, you know, they come back to this argument, and I imagine Jesus is just sort of doing the Picard facepalm at this moment, you know, just like, oh my goodness, come on, guys. And they come to him with the argument. They're coming to him to solve the argument. It's like, really? They say, who's the greatest? Now, here's where I admire our Lord. Because he doesn't just come back and clap back and say, I am. Right? Because that would have been true. Right? And it would have solved the dispute once and for all. I am. Now stop it. But instead of doing that, he tries to educate them. And he tries to serve them. So, their argument. What does he do? He gets a kid from the crowd. He says, come here. I mean, first of all, that was sort of not done in the sociological setting of the day. Because children were not positive examples of anything, right? Children were defective humans, essentially. Which, for some children, that still remains true. And for parents, you know what I'm talking about. Your kid seems like that at one point or another during your life. But Jesus calls a child to him, which sort of defies the behavior of the rabbis of the day. And with this child, what does he tell the 12? Yeah. Unless you become like this child, you're never going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Right. Or, and the last bit is, you know, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So, first of all, what does he mean by becoming like children? I don't know if it's innocence. There's something here that I think is going on. And here, yeah, and I think Elmore just got it right on the head. Now, and I'll tell you, I think it's parents whose kids are still little who get this. No offense to you, oldest, the best. Because I think of Aria, and I totally get this passage. Aria terrifies me. I'll tell you why. She'll stand on something. And she'll jump toward me. And there's not a doubt in her mind that I'm going to catch her. No matter how high it is, no matter where she is, no matter what she's doing, she's going to jump and I'm going to catch her. I mean, that is the kind of faith that I don't think any adult has. there's an absolute, unwavering trust. She doesn't do that with mommy. She only does that with me. Yeah. Aria is sick right now. So they're actually at home today. And I'll get Elmore in just a second. So there's that trust, right? But the other thing is, you know, I could tell her anything and she'll believe it. Sometimes my sense of humor gets the better of me. But she's starting to figure out when I'm teasing her and when I'm being serious, right? She's starting to figure that out, so I can't do that so much anymore. But now that she's figuring out that I'm teasing her, it actually opens up a whole other aspect of great fun between us, right? Between a father and his child. We can have a lot of silly fun that way, right? She asked me, what was it like, Daddy, when you were a boy? Were there dinosaurs? And I'm like, she's teasing, she's started to tease me with that question. So I'm like, they were all over the place and they were huge, right? It's like, you're teasing me. Yeah. But when she was younger, I could have told her that and she would have believed me. Like, you know, maybe some of the people in the room, yeah, sure. But I'm not that old, guys. But she would have believed me when she was younger. Because that's how she was. As we grow up, we stop trusting. Because we get hurt. And this lack of trust is our defense mechanism to prevent ourselves from getting hurt. But in her mind, you know, Daddy's never going to hurt her. And one day, there's going to come a day when I let her down, seriously. And I dread that day because it's going to crush me inside. To see that look on her and her eyes when she realizes that Daddy's not perfect. But that day has to come because she needs to understand that. Yeah. What's that, Cal? What's that? I didn't hear him. Won't be long. And it may not be long, right? And it may not be long, but, you know, she's going to have to understand that and come to terms with that for our relationship to be healthy as she gets older. And she's going to have to learn that, you know, Daddy's not perfect, right? But we do have a Father who is perfect. And we've got to trust Him and you know, we've got to do whatever He tells us. The way that, you know, little kids obey their parents before they hit 2.5 years old. Because, you know, we call it the terrible twos for a reason, right? And that's what I really think that's what he's talking about. It's as simple as that, right? And all the old axioms. I don't think it's so much about innocence, although it might be. I think it's about the trust. And it's about knowing our place, right? Because what happens when children get older is they start to push back against their parents. And they start to try and usurp their parents' place. You know, every daughter fights with her mother at some point. Right, Ruby? Notice I'm not asking the girls at that point. Every son fights with his dad, challenges his dad for authority and position. And we can't challenge God that way. First of all, it's just a dumb idea. Secondly, it's not going to work. But we have to maintain that, right? And, you know, when kids are still really little, you know, unfortunately, Aria seems to have inherited my sense of competition. I'm praying real hard. But before, you know, when she was still about 3 years old, she didn't really care who was better at one thing than another person. Everybody's just having fun being together. And there's a sense in which I think Jesus is talking about that too. You know, you look at kids who are 2-3 years old. They're not in competition with each other yet. You know, that starts around 4 or 5. You know, For some kids, it doesn't start until much later. Some people never seem to get that. But they're not worried about that yet. And I think he's also kind of talking about that too, saying, you guys got to get this whole thing out of your heads, right? And as we mature as human beings, we grow into what we are. And what we are at its core is large predatory mammals. That's what we are. We are large predatory mammals. Young children haven't yet learned how to be predators. But we learn as we grow older, don't we? We have to stop being predators. Because that's not what God's people are supposed to be. So, and by the way, that's what James and Paul called the psychikos man, the psychic man, or the natural man at sometimes. It's funny because it's the word from which we get psychic, but it means exactly the opposite of what psychic means in popular culture today. It means a human being who's governed solely by his large predatory mammal instincts and appetites. And that's the natural state for most people. And Jesus says you have to give that up. You've got to go back to being little kids who have not yet learned predation. And so I think, like, that's it, right? Become like children. Because predators, what do predators do? They exploit. They exploit. They devour, they consume. They abuse. What does Jesus have to say about those who abuse his people? Better to kill yourself than to suffer. Well, the thing is, if you kill yourself, you still got what I got coming to you, right? You know, when Jesus talks like this, I'm not sure whether he's just expressing how great his wrath is or if there's actually a difference in what some people receive in hell. I mean, I don't know. Because it certainly seems to, like, and there's, we can certainly tell at least his wrath is more intense for certain things than it is for others. I mean, whatever you believe about what people suffer in hell according to what sins they've committed or not, you can tell God's more angry at some sins than at others. And that certainly comes out here. Elmore, had your hand up.
Definitely Christ is talking to the disciples, because at this point, as King says, the disciples, because they're concerned about their social status still. And yet, on the other hand, unless you become like this child, you share that and everything that will happen, maybe that the spiritual, that's the priority of them, that they should focus rather than the social status that they were.
Right, and one of the disciples that became a part of this discussion when it was at its most heated was Peter. Right? Peter, James. It seemed like the three that were closest to Jesus were the ones whose egos had been puffed up by that closeness. Yeah, Peter, James, and John. Right? Peter, James, and John. Whose mom is it that comes to him? James and John's mom. The mother of the sons of Zebedee. She's the one that comes to him. You know, grant one to sit at your right hand and one to sit at your left. Don't even ask. Who is it that Jesus appears to after his death in the book of John while he's, you know, about to go? And he says three times, right? What does he say? First of all, who is he talking to? He's walking along the beach. He's got this one guy with him. He says, "Do you love me?" Peter. The one who is involved in this. What does he say to Peter? "Do you love me?" "Yes." "Feed my sheep." He asked him that question three times. Peter says yes three times. And Jesus says to him three times, feed my sheep. They need to learn to take care of the kids. Yeah, and then there's all the other things that go on in Peter's life. But by the time Peter is nearing the close of his life, he understands this. This comes out in 1 Peter 5. Like you can feel Matthew 18 in 1 Peter 5. The way Peter talks to elders when he addresses his comments to them, you can feel that, because it's to elders that he says, "Humble yourselves, therefore under the mighty hand of God." And that's the context of that statement, really. And so he's learned this from his own experience, from his journeys with the Master, and from his own life. And then he starts talking about, you know, not sin in general, right? Yeah, Sherry, how'd you end up? Right, and there's an element of that too, as far as, you know, new converts are concerned, is that they're in a very delicate place, right? And we have to have extra care with them. I'll say it this way. The Zen philosophy is a part of a major part of Japanese martial arts. When I was still very actively involved in that world, some parts of Zen, you know, get taught as far as this is concerned. And one of the major proponents that actually ends up being very useful in life, just in general, is maintaining what we call a beginner's mind. And you do it in everything, right? Now, when you're just focusing on martial arts, right, you learn to maintain a beginner's mind in that respect in the dojo, right? And, Zen sort of teaches you do that in all of life. And that's actually a very valuable thing to do, maintaining what we call a beginner's mind. Now, when you're a beginner and you're a novice at something, right, how much do you know about that subject? Nothing, right? You know absolutely nothing. So you're eager to learn, because you know that you know nothing. Now, what happens is you learn to a lot of people. What happens is you learn more. You start to know that you know more, right? And you start to get confident in the knowledge that you have. And sometimes you get overconfident in the knowledge that you have. And you think you know how to operate a firearm properly, and then you shoot yourself in the foot because you didn't clear the chamber. Well, now you got a trip to the hospital. Sometimes knowledge brings overconfidence. When we're discussing, you know, children and knowledge, a lot of kids are eager to learn stuff. They want to know more. They want to know more. They want to know more. And, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, dealing with new converts is, you know, certainly appropriate. But, you know, for those of us who've been at this for a while, we still need to maintain that mind, right? We still need to maintain the beginner's mind, in the sense in which we have to remind ourselves that we don't know as much as we think we know. And there's always more to learn. We should always be eager to acquire that knowledge. That's a whole other, I mean, there's, you know, this whole concept of being like little children. That's certainly, you know, true for us in how we treat new converts, but it's also good for us to, you know, go back to that ourselves. Ephesus had this kind of problem. Jesus sort of goes from here to talking about sort of temptations to sin in general, right? And, you know, he says, "Woe to the world for temptations to sin," right? It is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptations come. He says, if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. Now, first of all, does he mean this literally?
No.
Why doesn't he mean it literally? Can your hand hijack your central nervous system and cause you to do things that are wrong?
No.
And neither can your foot. I mean, your hand cannot control your thoughts or the rest of your body, right? It's not going to suddenly hijack your entire person, okay? So he obviously doesn't mean this literally. He's speaking hyperbolically. He's exaggerating to make a point, okay? But what does this exaggeration mean? You know, he goes on from that, right, saying, cut it off and throw it. If your eye causes you to sin, can your eye actually cause you to sin? No, your eye doesn't cause you to sin, it's your brain.
No, the eye sees something and
didn't
want it.
Yeah, but your brain decides to want it.
Yeah, but the brain doesn't see it.
Oh, come on. No, your eye doesn't cause you to sin. You can see things all the time and choose not to dwell on them, right? In his heart, right? Right. And he's not talking about eyes and hands and feet. What is he talking about? The intent of the mind, yes, but he's talking about something else. Keep in mind the context. What was said right before this? What is the world for temptations to sin? Now it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one through whom the temptation comes. Jesus is talking about people. He's talking about people. Certain people are just toxic influences that you don't need in your life. Sometimes they're named mom or dad or brother or friend. But if you know they're going to pull you away, you've got to cut that out of your life. Sometimes. Keep in mind the context. Now, keeping in mind the context, not just this statement, but of what came right before that, there's a greater context here to the 12, where he's saying, don't you dare become that person. Don't you dare become this person. Don't do that. Which one of the 12 ended up becoming that person? No. Peter. When he was in Antioch, led others astray by his actions. Peter became that person. And Paul, the one who isn't there for this, is the one who got in Peter's face about it. In Galatians 2, Paul records that, I rebuked Cephas to his face because he was wrong. Peter allowed this, he allowed himself to become this. And Paul straightened that out, didn't he? James too. In Acts 21, James, the brother of Christ, had allowed himself to become this as well. After he writes the book of James, which is a marvelous piece of wisdom literature, years later, sort of falls downward a little bit, unfortunately. So, be careful. So that's where we're going to close today, because we're out of time. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick up bottom of page 54, beginning about Matthew chapter 18, verse 10, right? We're going to start about verse 10. Last two questions, page 54. And then hopefully we'll be able to finish the rest of lesson 14 next week. So I want to thank everybody for their attendance, their participation in class this morning. And for the men of the congregation, a reminder once again, please meet in the back with Brother Cooper to make his job easier, sorting out the worship assignments. And then Now we are officially dismissed. Thank you, everybody, for being here.